Hi, listeners. This is a quick thank you for listening and for your ongoing support. If you're enjoying the program, please consider clicking the follow or subscribe button if you haven't done so already. It really helps us out. There's no better way to support us than doing that or sharing the show with a friend, colleague, family member, or any new or expecting parent in your life. It's totally appreciated. On with the show. Hi, I'm Sarah Trott, and welcome to the Fourth Trimester Podcast. I'm a new mama, and this podcast is all about postpartum care for the first few months following birth, the time period also known as the fourth trimester. My postpartum doula, Esther Gallagher, is my co-host. She's a mother, grandmother, perinatal educator, birth and postpartum care provider. Fourth trimester care, our topic, is about the practical, emotional, and social support parents and baby require. And importantly, it helps set the tone for the continuing journey of parenting. Hi, this is Sarah Trott.
Hi, it's Esther Gallagher.
Yay!
Sarah's sidekick.
We're here together.
Oh. If only that were true.
The opposite is true. We're back to pick up on a part one. This is a part two for planning your birth plan, or as we call it, birth intentions document. We did part one, many months ago, and I believe it's episode 13. If you want to go back and listen to episode 13 or check out the birth plan itself, which is a downloadable document on our website. So you can download that and then follow along with us as we go and we talk. But really, I'm going to hand the mic over to Esther in just a moment. Before I do, I'm going to remind everyone that we have our website, which is fourthtrimesterpodcast.com. You can follow us on Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook, on Pinterest, even if you like. And we'd love to interact with you in all of those ways. Our emails are available on our website as well. If you look at the About Us page, you can sponsor us. And in fact, we would love it if you would sponsor us, actually, for as little as a dollar a show. That would help us out a lot because we're a small operation and every little bit goes a long way for us. So thank you so much to our existing sponsors, and please do participate in that way if you can.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. So Esther, okay, we left off talking about consulting about medical procedures. So let's just get everyone in the right mindset here. So we're thinking about what's actually happening in a home birth or a hospital birth or other environment kind of
center.
Place. Mm-hmm. Yeah, birth center. So you're there, you're in the moment. This is talking about everything that's happening during the birth itself. And, having these things written down is really helpful for everyone in the room to kind of get on the same page about if something comes up, how would we want to respond? So that there aren't that many open-ended questions, because in the moment, I think everyone wants to be focused on having a healthy baby and a healthy mom. So, all right, we left off talking about EFM.
Yeah, so we left off talking about getting some privacy around making any non-emergency decisions about medical procedures, et cetera. And so we're going to jump in and talk about electronic fetal monitoring, which is pretty standard in the hospital setting. Everybody gets some amount of that done during your labor and birth. In a home birth setting, there would be a protocol for how often to listen to the baby, and that listening would be done with a fetoscope or a Doppler, and the midwife would just touch the mom's tummy with the device and listen through a contraction or two or three every so often. So like every hour, depending on what stage the labor was at. You would not, in a home birth setting, have a monitor strapped to your tummy the whole time during labor. Now, in the hospital setting, sometimes you have to really advocate for yourself if you want what we call intermittent monitoring. That would be a term that you could use in your preferences plan. And so long as you came into the hospital having experienced a healthy, normal pregnancy and a healthy, normal course of labor, you would be entitled to not be subjected to continuous fetal monitoring. There are good reasons why you might be subjected to continuous fetal monitoring, but if it's your preference not to, it's something that you can address in your birth preferences, and in which case they would have to be giving you a good reason why they feel your baby requires continuous monitoring. Now, along with that fetal monitoring, you would also be having your contractions monitored. And typically with these external devices, that's a rough guesstimate about how strong your contractions are. It does not give us any sort of specific measurement, but it will tell us if the monitoring is working appropriately. It will tell us how often your contractions are and more or less how long they are, and maybe relative to each other, how strong they are. But it doesn't actually measure the strength of your uterus as it's contracting. The next thing on our list is no internal fetal monitoring unless absolutely necessary. And
may I ask a question, actually?
Oh, absolutely, sure.
Okay, going back to the fetal monitoring, the external part, like that's a really big strap that goes over the belly and around the whole body. And I remember all too clearly that when in labor, I really didn't want anything on me because it was painful, especially the back labor when the big contractions started happening. So I see a very practical purpose. I just wanted to add this in to avoiding having that on if it's not medically necessary, because it'll be a lot more comfortable during labor.
Yeah.
I'm going to be able to move around and walk around and not be chained to something that's 2 feet away and have it be squeezing you. Yeah. Oh, ouch.
Yeah. There are a couple ways that they can strap those monitors on you. And one's like a tube top that goes around your belly all the way around. It's wide. And some moms actually like that. Even when they're not being monitored, they like to leave that on because something about that traction feels good to them. And other moms, it's claustrophobic, like just feels terrible. The other way is separate straps for each monitor device that go around, and they're about 3 inches wide and they're very stretchy. And some moms find that they're just ungainly and they slip around a lot, and other moms find that they're just right and they're not that noticeable. So these are things, you know, that most hospitals have both, believe it or not. So you can experiment with those in the event that there was a good reason why you were going to be continuously monitored. Neither one is a perfect solution. In my 39 years of watching people in labor, like, there's always something about them that's a little irritating. Now, that's not a reason why we shouldn't do it, but if there's good reason that you don't have to have them, that's always nice. And the thing to really ask about is, can you not wear those things? And when you need to be monitored, the nurse can just hold the fetal monitor to your tummy while you're having that surge, right? That is actually possible to do. Right? Just like it's also possible in most settings to use the remote telemetry. That's a device that allows you to walk away from the monitor without being plugged in and tethered by a 4-foot cord.
Right.
So these are all some of the options around touching in with your baby and making sure that they are faring well with your labor, which is important. Right? It's just that it doesn't necessarily have to be constant.
Yep.
So the other way to actually hear a baby's heartbeat is with an internal fetal monitor. And it's actually a device that has a tiny little corkscrew at the end of it that is actually embedded in the skin of the baby's scalp, which scares most people. I know it scared me thinking and hearing about it. I haven't seen babies react terribly badly to them, but what do I know? I mean, I don't know what the possible side effects are of that. But I will say that while I think it's to be avoided, and I think hospitals try to avoid it unless it is actually necessary, in an instance where we're very concerned about the baby and we're not sure based on the external fetal monitor whether or not the baby's actually doing as well as we think they should be, and we think they might not be doing well, the internal fetal monitor is typically a good way to just get only the baby's heartbeat, no other external noise, and find out whether or not they're in a good zone. So I've been at births where I've seen, you know, nurses messing around with the external monitor, causing the mom a great deal of discomfort while pushing, and not getting a heartbeating trace that is reassuring, right, at a critical moment. And while I would prefer not to use the internal monitor, I have on occasion suggested to the attending person who's about to catch the baby that they use one so that we can be reassured, because I'm pretty sure the baby is okay and I think the mom needs to just not have the discomfort of the external monitor being crammed around on her pubic bone while she's trying to actually push her baby out, which would be the safest thing to do, is actually get the baby born. So I think that there are good instances where maybe it wasn't necessary because the baby was doing well, but nobody knew the baby was well. So this was reassuring to everybody. And then the mother could actually have some ease and grace in the pushing, as an example of maybe an appropriate use that wasn't strictly necessary in my mind. and again, it's because of the electronic fetal monitoring, the external fetal monitor is such a bad design. It's a bad design. Let's say it together. Bad design.
Bad design.
Within the next 5 years, I expect to see a much smarter engineering job, design job. And if we don't see it in the next 10 years, I don't know why women will keep having their babies in the hospital. Because it's long overdue. So our next item is keep vaginal exams to a minimum. There are a couple of reasons why that could be important to you. One is that you may be somebody who experiences a great deal of discomfort in labor, both being on your back and being examined vaginally. You can expect that it's going to be pretty uncomfortable to go through exams. There are good reasons to have exams during labor, but it's not a good reason to have an exam just because the doctor happens to show up and wants to, right? So good reasons would be that you feel that your labor is changing and you want to make a good decision about whether and how and in what forms you want to experience better comfort with your labor. Remembering that labor must get longer, stronger, closer together, much more intense. So as your labor gets that way and you're thinking, gosh, I'm not sure that I want to hew to my my intention of having a quote-unquote natural childbirth, I'm really thinking about some other medical pain management, then I always think that it's a really great idea to have an exam to determine where you are currently in your labor, just in terms of dilation and effacement, vis-a-vis how long you've been in labor, and some very broad, loose prediction around how long you will be in labor. Because I think those are the sorts of things that we have to talk about when moms are thinking that they somehow can't go on. As Sarah probably remembers, it's one thing to find out that you're 3 centimeters, and it's another thing to find out you're 7 centimeters. And what that means in terms of where your labor's going and how it's going can make the difference between, you know, getting pain medication that you maybe later would prefer not to have gotten because you have this idea that you wanted a natural childbirth, and being able to ask your birth team to sort of lean in, or expect them to, really, you shouldn't have to ask, lean in and support you a little more deeply, get you into the shower or the tub to kind of get you over the hump of transition labor. That kind of information should be very, very helpful to your doula in terms of helping you make good choices around what you need for support, and also might inform you as to whether you feel like you're going to be able to hang in there a little longer or not. I mean, it's perfectly wide open, your choice, no judgments about that in any way, but you know, that's a place where you and your birth team can make, help you make good decisions about where to go next.
Mm-hmm. So I have a good friend who was having her second baby, a little boy, and she was in the hospital, and she thought she was quite a ways along. The doctor was very busy. Some nurses had come in and out, and they said, well, all right, let's get your epidural going. And she said, well, can you tell me how close I am? Because I feel like I'm close. And if I'm close, then I'd just like to go for it and try it. And they said, well, we can't check you. And the doctor's not going to be here for like 15 minutes or so. So do you want to just have it? Because now's the chance, either have it or you don't. And she said, well, fine. If you put me in that situation, I guess I'll just do it. She got her epidural. The doctor walked in the room and he said, all right, you're ready to go, push. And she just felt so disappointed that had they just checked, mm-hmm. She would have really known where she was and probably been able to have a natural birth without the epidural. No problem. Yeah.
And I have to say that's, you know, that's a kind of emotional blackmail that should never happen to women in the hospital setting. Like, I've heard that story so many times. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, so many times. Like, rather than saying to a mom who's like really working hard, wow, you're doing great, you know, let's see what we can do to help you through this phase, because it's probably going to be soon, which is way more encouraging, right? Mm-hmm. And why a nurse couldn't have checked her is beyond me. Nurses can do vaginal exams, mm-hmm. right? They can.
Just to see how hard they're going. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and especially when an epidural is a question, right? Because it is, by the way, people, always a question. It's never obligatory. The idea that you would feel obliged to make a decision about when and where to have your epidural is wrong, and you should never be faced with that kind of idea. But I see this idea come up again and again and again, and it's just not true. And right, you might have to wait for your epidural a little longer mm-hmm. if the anesthesiologist happens to be giving someone else an epidural. But that doesn't mean you should have gotten an epidural, right?
Right.
Doesn't mean you should have gotten an epidural.
Would you say the same is true for other drugs like the Pitocin or pain relievers, things like that? Pitocin, which is to speed up labor.
Certainly. Well, in any case, if you were thinking that you wanted something because you felt like it was early on, you know, they just don't give you fentanyl once you start to be in really active labor.
And what,
so
what's
it's
that?
Not a choice. So fentanyl is a narcotic, right? It's a very powerful, potent narcotic that, because of its deep power to, you know, depress your body and make you feel sleepy and drowsy. And for some people, they can actually fall asleep under the influence of this drug. Mm-hmm. But because, unlike morphine, it's short acting, it's used for women who are sort of in that early middle phase of labor, maybe in early active labor, but not very far along in the process. Mm-hmm. The reason being that, of course, as with morphine, your baby will be under the influence as well, and they want to know how dilated you are and make a good prediction about when you're going to deliver your baby, so that your baby is not under the influence of a narcotic when they're born. Okay. So you should never, honestly, like, I don't think it's intelligent to use morphine or fentanyl if you have not been recently examined to tell where you are in terms of your effacement and dilation, because those drugs should only be used in the latent or early phase of labor.
You said late or early? Or
latent. So before early. 3 centimeters.
Early.
Yeah.
Only in the earliest stages.
Yeah. And just to be clear, you know, a woman who's been having contractions that have been keeping her up all night, who isn't yet dilating and effacing, might be a good candidate for some morphine and some sleep, mm-hmm. right? Because it might be 3 more nights before she delivers a baby.
Yeah.
So while I am certainly as big a proponent for quote unquote natural childbirth as there is, I also think there are some very, very good applications of medicine, including narcotics, for certain kinds of labor that women are experiencing. So, some morphine sleep in a late labor, what we call prodromal labor, might make the difference for a mother who's hoping to avoid an epidural, right? Because she'll get some sleep and maybe feel better energy for the labor that she ultimately has. Mm-hmm. No promises, but, you know, certainly it's something that I think is worthy of a try for moms.
Right.
So,
and since we're on the topic, just kind of continuing along the path of what we were talking before, the relationship between the fetal monitoring and the drugs is really hand in hand, isn't it? Oftentimes, right?
I've heard certainly, that. Yeah. If you're going to have fentanyl, I think that they are going to want you to also have an IV, perhaps, and or be continuously monitoring the baby to see that they respond appropriately.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've not necessarily with the morphine, believe it or not.
Oh, right.
They'll actually send you home with that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a much milder drug.
It'd be much nicer to sleep at home, I think,
mm-hmm.
in one's own bed if that were an option.
Mm-hmm.
So I've heard about the cycle of, as it relates to cesareans, for example, a cycle of Pitocin, which increases cramping and increases contractions or surges. That's really painful. So as a result, get some pain medication.
Yeah. And that's what people say about it. And I'm here to tell you that if for some reason you are a candidate for Pitocin to augment your labor, the best thing for you is to consider it as a natural augmentation of labor. The trick with Pitocin, and they no longer give Pitocin to a woman who isn't starting to have a ripe cervix. In the old days, the reason Pitocin was so daunting for women is that we did not have misoprostol and Cervidil to help ripen the cervix to get it to a state where it was going to be able to dilate. Mm-hmm. Okay. The other thing about Pitocin is that often because of all the distractions involved in being in the hospital, having an IV, having the fetal monitor going, etc., women often aren't in a state where they're really tuned into their labor. And so they tend to experience the Pitocin contractions sort of crashing into them before they're quote unquote ready. Mm-hmm. Okay. Whereas if they were just kind of internal the way women often allow themselves to become, with a labor that's quote unquote natural, right? They're just sort of committed to labor and they're in their labor. And so when I'm working with clients who are either being induced or augmented in their labor, I try to remind them that we don't have to talk. It's okay to like just listen to the labor and listen deeply and hear those little quiet notes of a contraction about to come. Because, you know, I'm sure you even remember, Sarah, like there was a point in your labor where, you know, if you didn't give every ounce of your attention to just being present for what was actually happening in the moment, it was going to crash over you like a big old wave, mm-hmm. right? And mess you up. Mm-hmm. So I think that the lore about Pitocin is a little heavy-handed. You know, it's a little, it sets women up for a kind of collapse around the project of having a baby mm-hmm. in a way that it doesn't have to. With good support and a good understanding of how induction and augmentation actually works, a woman can actually get through a labor that actually involves these things quite well.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes, you know, you have to consider that the potential trade-off between no Pitocin and Pitocin is a labor that may never quite get itself all the way together and is going to drag out in such a way that a woman will necessarily become exhausted, will necessarily need that epidural, and then gets the Pitocin anyway. She might not have to deal with the Pitocin, mm-hmm. you know, or the labor for that matter, which is fair enough. But in the meantime, if she's sort of had a labor that has been dragging on and isn't making progress and has the potential to exhaust her, a little bit of Pitocin might have organized her labor in a very progressive fashion. So while I'm all for avoiding these things whenever possible, I also have seen these very same things make all the difference for moms who wanted to have, you know, wanted to give birth vaginally without drugs, right? It's like, okay, now I'm having an actually progressive labor. That means I'm going to have my baby today and not be exhausted because it's day 3 or 4.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, these are all things that we have to kind of, it's one of the reasons to have a pretty experienced doula who can support you through all of these decision points and ask you the question. So how are you feeling right now? Mm-hmm. You know, if I hear a client say, well, I feel okay, but I also feel like I'm getting tired and I'm getting a little discouraged because it feels like things aren't moving a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, okay. Then we can have that discussion about what are the ways that we can attempt to have things move along. We can talk about the quote unquote natural ones and the quote unquote not natural ones and make good decisions about what to try next. It's all a big experiment.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, those are discussions.
Right. And that sounds like a gentle approach, right? You're listening to your body. You're having a conversation with someone.
Hi, listeners. I have some exciting news to share with you today. We've partnered with Every Mother, your go-to destination for evidence-based exercise therapy regimens. Whether you're dealing with diastasis recti, preparing for birth, or navigating postpartum recovery, Every Mother has your back. With personalized daily routines tailored to your core and pelvic floor needs, they're here to support you every step of the way. Say hello to a stronger, healthier you with Every Mother. Visit their website today and use code 4thTrimester10 for 10% off your personalized regimen. That's 4th spelled out, F-O-U-R-T-H, trimester10 for 10% off, because every mother deserves the very best.
I've heard of cases where someone is sort of thrown into the deep end during their labor, hit with a ton of Pitocin pretty early. Mm-hmm. It's extremely painful. Have to have the feel-good drugs to counteract that.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly now we're just on constant watch to make sure that the baby's heart rate doesn't drop, which is what the fetal monitoring is for,
mm-hmm.
For a large part. And then if the baby's heart rate drops to a certain point, then it's okay, cesarean.
Right. And those scenarios can precipitate.
Right. And yeah. So part of the thing that was really interesting for me, just as an observer of cases like this, is that those heavy, heavy contractions, I think you might have even said this in a previous conversation, that the body is squeezing that baby really hard in a way that kind of isn't as natural as if the body were on its own. And that squeezing is sometimes what can cause the baby's heart to race or react in a funny way.
Right. So here's what babies need to get through a surge, right? They need good oxygenation between the contractions so that they can have enough oxygen on board during the squeeze that they make it through, right? So there's two elements to this. One is, what is the quality of the squeeze? Really, usually it's duration. Like, is it going on too long?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, I've seen women in quote unquote natural labor have contractions that need to stop and aren't stopping. Okay. Just so you know, that's possible.
Okay.
That's called a tetanic contraction, like tetanus, where the muscle grips and doesn't relax.
I just hear the Titanic ship.
Yeah.
Yes. Most people are out of control. To the ocean.
Yeah. Right. So tetanic contractions are possible in nature.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And on occasion, Pitocin might precipitate something like that as well. So that's why we're monitoring the baby, as good a reason as any. Is this baby getting enough oxygen that whatever contractions the mom is having, the baby can make their way through that contraction to the end without sort of dropping down because they no longer have enough oxygen to kind of carry them through. So we see those decelerations in the heartbeat at the end, like after a contraction's over, then the baby sinks. And that's kind of what we call an ominous, you know, reading of the baby. And I have seen that turn around just by getting mothers to breathe deeply in and all the way out continuously throughout not only the contraction itself, but in between. In other words, don't just fall asleep and not breathe between surges, okay, which some moms do in transition labor, which is the longest, strongest, closest together surges that most women have, okay? So again, I want to emphasize that just because you have Pitocin doesn't mean that will happen.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. It's not about scaring someone out of ever using it.
Right. And you're responsible for breathing well for your baby during labor, whatever stage of labor you're in. So nice, deep, slow, thorough ins, thorough outs, so that you're making room for a lot of oxygen in your body. In fact, I've seen women turn those decelerations around completely by themselves by doing what we would call in physical training, front loading, right? Where you so notice I'm taking a really strong in breath and I'm really blowing it out. I'm getting rid of that CO2 so that I make room for oxygen, and I'm doing a kind of hyperventilation style. I'm really trying to get that loaded on heavy before I do the next thing.
Yeah.
Now I feel better too, by the way. And it really wakes you up and makes you feel kind of less pain and really ready for the next thing. So normally I wouldn't want a mom hyperventilating, which is actually usually hypoventilating, where they're right, they're not actually breathing out and getting rid of the CO2.
Yeah.
Okay, you have got to release the CO2. And then take a big suck in and get the oxygen loaded on your red blood cells for the baby.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, great question, Sarah, because I'm really seeing the difference with my clients in terms of like, can they just wake up and be part of the project and really help themselves and their baby get through this phase? Because it's usually just a phase.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But it is a phase where it's often the case that the hospital will say, okay, things are going wrong. You know, we've got to intervene.
And then, and then unplanned cesarean, which is such a high rate here in the United States. And I just want to mention that although the data has been available for a long time, we noticed that Yelp recently for California and maybe other states too, made data on cesarean rates hospital by hospital available on Yelp. I mean, we don't get sponsored by Yelp. That would be great if they wanted to sponsor us and they hear this, please do, by all means. But I'm just mentioning it because it's a handy little tool. And if you're thinking about, you know, what you'd like to happen, that could be part of a consideration. Although I think the truth is that the more interesting data would be cesarean by doctor, and that's not necessarily available.
Yeah.
But by hospital, is insightful as well.
And I think what I'll say about that, Sarah, is that when you're looking at hospital statistics, one of the things that should be taken into consideration, and I do not know whether Yelp does this, is whether or not that hospital is, say, for instance, a magnet hospital for high-risk mothers, right? Mm. That's going to naturally sway the number of C-sections, because if you've got a high-risk mom, you're more likely to need to intervene on that pregnancy and or labor and delivery than you would with a mother who comes in presenting with a very healthy end of pregnancy.
Yeah, the data comes from, not from Yelp themselves, but from an underlying system. We'll have to look it up and mention it on this on our website. But I believe that was taken into account.
Yeah.
I believe they took care of that to even out the scores.
Yeah. There was a good little article or TED Talk or something where the person sort of parsing all of this said, you know, what we really need in America in general are less unnecessary C-sections and more necessary C-sections. So in other words, there are situations where a C-section could be done that would actually be proactively the best, make for the best outcome, and those aren't being done.
Yeah.
Right? And so we're pushing some pregnancies past where they're healthy and normal, and then not doing a C-section that might have actually meant a better outcome for mom and baby. But we're doing far too many on balance. We're doing far too many C-sections that could have and should have been avoided. So we're in that funny place mm-hmm. where we're not utilizing the technology of C-sections in the way it was really should have been intended to be used.
Mm-hmm.
Just to circle back around to C-sections, one of the things that doesn't often get mentioned is that because part of the drug mix for the epidural involves a narcotic like morphine, those sorts of drugs tend to drop mother's blood pressure. And that's one of the reasons why if you didn't have one yet, you would be given an IV to prop up your blood pressure, to make sure you're very well hydrated when those drugs take effect so that your blood pressure does not drop precipitously, which would affect the baby. It affects the blood flow through the placenta and the cord to the baby. So it's not a great idea to get an epidural without making sure you're well hydrated. And by the way, being decently hydrated for labor is important in any case. It can slow your labor down. It can make for a very problematic labor if your muscles aren't well hydrated. And by that, I don't mean that you drink a gallon of water. Just don't do that. That's not helpful at all. Sip hydrating beverages continuously and make sure you pee every couple of hours. That's baseline for getting through labor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Another reason to keep vaginal exams to a minimum besides just the discomfort of it and the fact that you don't really need to know unless you need to know is that especially if your bag of waters is open, then each time we do a vaginal exam, we're actually potentially pushing bacteria in and up towards the uterus and increasing the potential risk for infection. So that's another good reason to keep those to a minimum. And having said all that, I just want to reiterate that it's just a really good idea to get a vaginal exam if you're at a place in your labor where you feel like you need to make a decision about anything. Knowing your status of labor is a good piece of information. And if you're going to be examined, before you get examined, it's a good idea to ask the examiner, can you please check not only my dilation and effacement, but also the position of the baby in terms of descent. So we call that station. That you want to know what station the baby's in and what position the head's in. So does that mean your baby's anterior, posterior, or asynclitic? Those are all good words to use in labor or for your doula to use in labor, especially if they know what they mean.
What do they mean?
So anterior baby is a baby who's in the proper, for most pelvises, the proper position. The back of the baby's head is towards mom's pubis, right? Pubic bone.
So if a woman was laying, if mom is laying on her back, then the baby's back is facing the ceiling.
Right.
Yes.
So the mother's anterior, okay, that means the front. The posterior means the back, right? In fact, some people use posterior to mean butt. The mom's posterior is her backside. A baby who's in a posterior position can make for a longer, more challenging labor with a tremendous amount of back pain. In which case, if you're having any of that, get on your hands and knees and stay there.
That's when if mom's laying on her back, the baby's back is also facing the floor.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So optimally, the baby is in an anterior position with the back of their head slightly to the mother's left until they get into position for pushing. Asynclitic means that the baby's head is actually tilted in relationship to the pelvis itself. So if you think of the plane, like a flat plane, imaginary plane across the floor of the pelvis or the midpoint of the pelvis, the baby's head is not also in that same plane. So one of the ears is up higher than the other ear, for instance, or maybe the chin is tucked over towards one shoulder or the other, or something of that nature where they're just not kind of slipping into the pelvis directly with the back of their head, which can mean the baby can have a little more difficulty getting pushed through. Mm-hmm. All of these things can be, potentially can be adjusted, right? So it's just good to know what's happening and make good decisions about anything that is. Allow the mother to assume birthing positions of her choice. So a mother who's not under the influence of epidurals could be standing and or squatting to push. She could be lying on one on her side to push the baby out with legs up in a otherwise semi-squatting position. There might be a squatting bar attached to the bed that the mother can use. Plenty of babies are born with moms on their hands and knees, and that's particularly important if a baby's going to be born posterior. It's actually a good position to give birth to a posterior baby. You could imagine other possibilities. Leaning over the bed, so not quite hands and knees, a mom standing, but leaning forward.
We may end up getting into part three of this, but we'll just keep going.
Okay, so, and, you know, during the pushing phase, you may try all kinds of different positions before you finally feel like you've found the one that feels progressive for you. So do experiment if that seems right. That's the kind of situation where it's really helpful to a mom to have people around who are going to suggest shifts and changes depending on how pushing is going. Mm-hmm. And we'll do two more of these because I think that it's a great sort of segue to the last part.
Okay. Yeah, maybe getting to
part three,
which would be after the
after birth. Yes. Yeah. It says, please use warm compress and counter pressure instead of perineal massage to help avoid tearing or episiotomy. So, most moms are going to be able to give birth without, I mean, most of us on the planet or having been born over the millions of years that we've been around would have been given birth by women who had very little assistance and would have given birth without major tearing. So warm compresses just help the perineum kind of relax and stretch naturally as the baby's being born. And it also is kind of nice for moms to have a place to kind of focus their pushing efforts. So if they can feel that warmth and feel kind of the slight pressure on the perineum, it helps them focus where they're pushing the baby towards. perineal massage used to be something that was quite popular. It still is among some people who learn to do it, and it can be overdone and cause perineal tissue to swell. And so we want to be very gentle if we're doing any perineal massage or pressure of any kind. Episiotomies, at least in the part of California I live in now, are rather rare. Really, they should only be used in one of two cases, and that is that we need to emergently get a baby out who's really not doing well. And that's going to help to do that. And that's rare that that's the case. And in most cases, you can get the baby out without an episiotomy. Or if a mom has a very tight hymenal ring that's intact and isn't going to release in order that the baby can come out. So I've seen this on a couple of occasions, and mom's pushing brilliantly. Baby's come down really nice, and now there's like a tight circular band that's not allowing the perineum to actually stretch out of the way of the baby, and it's actually holding the baby back. And so in all the cases where I've seen an episiotomy offered, it was offered, right? Like it wasn't, there was no forcing it. There was no saying you have to do this. It was like, well, would you like us to? And the moms have all said, I need the baby to be out. Like the baby is like almost out, and I can't just sit here with the baby almost out. And, you know, they're quite careful in those cases to support the perineum and do a very tiny snip to just release that tight band of tissue. So there are occasions when they could be a good idea. There's almost no other reason to do it than those two reasons.
Yeah, the idea of any kind of slicing and dicing or tearing of that very sensitive area is terrifying.
Yeah, most women, if they think much about it, don't want to think much about it.
Right, no.
Yeah.
But in that moment, I would have to say, based on limited experience, but you're not feeling that anyway. There's so much going on. Mm-hmm. It's sort of the least concern, and a natural tear here or there is, if that happens, is probably right.
Mm-hmm. And heals well.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Especially if mom is otherwise healthy at the end of pregnancy, then, you know, eating a really healthy, nourishing, pro-healing diet without sugar in it is going to be the thing to do to help you get healed and recovered from any kind of perineal tearing.
Yeah.
And the daily sitz bath, particularly if it has the appropriate herb tea added to it.
And that's a lay down bath, not the toilet tub bath.
Right. I like the one where we clean the tub really thoroughly for mom each time. And we would have, you know, brewed the tea and then strained it into the tub and 4 inches of warm water, and mom can sit in that for 20 minutes and just very cleansing, healing, and astringent, and helps all that tissue come back together naturally.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
not to say that major tears aren't a real thing. That's different. We're just talking about the minor ones.
Yeah.
So, okay.
So now the last thing we'll say before we go to part three next time is that many people giving birth as a couple or as a family, other, you know, that aren't single parents, might like to have their partner receive the baby. And that's perfectly okay. If that appeals to you and you'd like to try that, then the person who's supporting you in those moments, the doctor or midwife, will support you in receiving the baby into your hands when they're born, and then help you bring the baby onto mom's tummy after that. No reason why you can't.
All right. So we will stop there. We're going to wrap up and say thank you for listening to part two of the birth plan.
Also, we'll try to get part three to you soon.
birth intentions. Yes.
Sorry.
Okay. We'll get part three out soon. We know a lot of you are listening eagerly and awaiting this. We know it's going a bit long, but it's worth touching on these subjects and making sure you understand sort of what these decisions look like and what the implications are, if possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just as a sneak preview, we're going to talk about cesarean birth. And then we're also going to talk about the immediate postpartum, right after birth.
All right. Thank you so much. See you next time. Don't forget to check out our website, fourthtrimesterpodcast.com. Sign up for our newsletter. Like us on Facebook. Sponsor us, please, on patreon.com.
Please.
Thank you so much, and we'll see you again soon.
Thanks. Thanks, Sarah.
Bye.
Bye.
You can subscribe to this podcast in order to hear more from us. Thank you for listening, everyone, and I hope you'll join us next time on the fourth trimester. The theme music on this podcast was created by Sean Trott. Hear more at soundcloud.com/Sean Trott. Special thanks to my true loves, my husband Ben, daughter Penelope, and baby girl Evelyn. Don't forget to share the fourth trimester podcast with any new and expecting parents. I'm Sarah Trott. Goodbye for now.
Hello again, bicycle man. I know you're doing all that you can. I wrote the song, simple and true. I wrote the song, I'll sing a song for you. You got your wheels, you got your gears. You ride around town without any fear. You got your pedals, you got your brakes. You always wear your helmet for safety's sake. Hello again, bicycle man. I know you're doing all that you can. I wrote the song, simple and true. I wrote the song, I sing a song for you. Hello again, bicycle man. I know you're doing the best that you can. I wrote the song, simple and true. I wrote the song, I sing a song for you.